Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Christina Mittermeier, worked as a communications director at Conservation International in the early 90s, she realized that people pay a lot more attention to beautiful photographs than they ever do to science. When her youngest child was three, she decided to go to school to study photography. She has since published and edited 24 coffee table books on conservation issues, and her work has been published in publications including Science and Nature. She was recently recognized as one of the world's top 40 influential outdoor photographers by Outdoor Magazine. She also co-founded Sea Legacy, a nonprofit that creates powerful images to change the narrative around the world's oceans. Christina has been a writer and photographer for the past 25 years, and her work centers on the delicate balance between human well-being and healthy ecosystems. And Christina Mittermeier joins us on the line from Vancouver Island. Hi, Christina. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I'm so glad you're joining us, and your photographs are so beautiful. I have to say, you know, it's been kind of difficult to follow what's going on in the government every single day, and it was nice just to take a break and just stare at your photographs, which are just beautiful. So thank you so much.
I feel that these distractions of our government make it even more imperative that we pay attention to what's happening to our natural world.
It's so true, and I wanted to ask you about that because so many of us have been doing some deep soul searching given our political crisis. Donald Trump is a climate change denier. His advisor, Myron Ebell, is a climate denier. In fact, he said the green movement is the greatest threat to freedom in the world. And so I just wonder, when you look at what's happening in the United States, how do you see your role as a conservationist and a photographer changing, if at all?
Well, I see the role becoming even more urgent, if that's even possible. And, you know, the reason these people are deniers of climate change is because it's the narrative that suits their, you know, financial interest. They have their money, their hands in the money, you know, and they're not going to let go of that, even if it means the demise of the natural fabric that sustains all life on Earth, not just theirs. It's a really dangerous game they're playing, and it's really sad. And I feel that, you know, it's not just for journalists that are covering the protests and what's happening in the White House. It's for all journalists, including photojournalists like myself, who work in the far reaches of the ocean and, you know, out there in the wilderness. Mm. We are reporting on what's happening as well.
What are you hearing from your fellow photojournalists? Because you're right, you all see things that most of us will never see. You know, whether it's diving in the ocean or going to the Arctic, you have traveled extensively around the world and you take photos of indigenous people. So you're lucky enough to see things and experience things that most people don't.
Absolutely. And with the privilege of being able to go and see these things firsthand, also comes the huge responsibility to do something about it. And so what we're seeing, just, I mean, we've known for a long, long time that this extinction crisis was coming. We in the environmental conservation community have been trying to stop it with all the tools at our disposal, including science and photography and filmmaking. But what we're seeing now, Rose, is becoming really terrifying. I mean, we're seeing, for example, just in the last few months, 500 baby southern right whales that have washed up on the shores of Argentina dead, and we don't know why. Mm. And, you know, you're seeing things like all the starfish in Puget Sound dead. These are symptoms of a very sick planet, and it doesn't matter who's going to be in the White House in the next 10, 20 years if we don't have a healthy natural system that supports us. It's not going to matter. So we have to keep working for it.
On your Facebook page, you recently posted an article about climate scientists predicting that the Arctic's summer ice will be nearly gone in 20 years, threatening a vibrant ecosystem that includes seals and polar bears and a way of life for indigenous peoples.
Absolutely. So the Arctic is one of those places where we're seeing change happening the fastest. And the thing is that for most people, because they will never experience the Arctic firsthand, it feels like a very far removed thing. You know, if polar bears are starving, well, it's not their problem. But the work that we're trying to do with Sea Legacy is to connect the dots and say, if the Arctic is experiencing faster melting every year, it's just becoming more and more accelerated, in 20 years, there's going to be no sea ice left in the summer months. And what that means is that species like polar bears are not going to be able to go out and hunt on the sea ice, and they're going to starve, and they're going to come closer to extinction. And that is just the canary in the coal mine. You know, all of these things will eventually come back and affect each and every one of us wherever we live.
And this is really important because we've done so many shows about messaging, about the conservation movement and how they communicate or don't communicate with the public. And so many scientists on our show over the years have said, we need to do a better job of actually speaking to the public. And now we're learning that scientists are thinking about running for office because of what we're dealing with. Tell us a little bit about your background, because in interviews you have said that when you worked as a communications director at Conservation International back in the early 90s, at that time you realized that people pay a lot more attention to beautiful photographs than they ever do to, you know, science brochures that these groups put out.
Yes, you know, if we think about the environmental movement going back 30, 40 years, we invested a lot of money in the beginning in science because we didn't understand what was happening, and it was important that we invest in, you know, the scientific tools to really get a grasp on what's going on. Where we have failed to invest is in communications, because the public at large doesn't feel the sense of urgency for what's happening. So in the 1990s, when I was asked to be the director of communications at Conservation International, it became clear to me that the allocation of resources was heavily slanted towards science, and still is. Most foundations are still more interested in investing in more and more science, whereas the budgets for communications are always really small in comparison. The interesting thing is that budgets for communications in most environmental groups are also being allocated for fundraising and not for the sharing of the message. So I have been working for the past 10, 15 years to try to correct this, try to educate funders and donors and conservation groups as to the imperative of investing in communications. And it's true. You know, we are visual animals. We are very distracted with all sorts of media all the time, and we respond better to beautiful imagery. And hopefully that imagery helps us bring the stories to people in a more digestible way than scientific narrative.
Tell us more about Sea Legacy, the nonprofit you and your partner Paul Nicklin founded in 2015. You're going to go on exhibitions around the world to create compelling photographs and videos for conservation groups to use?
Yes, so Sea Legacy is just our urgent response to what we see happening out there, because Paul and I work as underwater photographers and filmmakers. We have a front row seat into what's happening in the world's oceans, and we wanted to find a way to give back. And so we identified this need for the highest quality visuals in the conservation community. And the way that we approach it is we raise our own funding. We prepare and carry out these expeditions around the world. We have 50 identified. And then we work with the conservation community on campaigns that are designed to protect and restore marine ecosystems.
And where's your next trip?
Believe it or not, I leave tomorrow. Paul and I go to Antarctica for a whole month.
Wow. And tell us...
We're super excited.
So excited, so lucky. Tell us what you're planning to do there. What are you looking for?
This is a fantastic and very exciting expedition. We are doing it in partnership with the National Geographic Society. And we are going to the Antarctic Peninsula to create the documentation, both in photography and film and virtual reality, of this beautiful and so important ecosystem, to try to accelerate the creation of a marine protected area in the Antarctic, in the East Antarctic Peninsula. It's currently not protected, and it's subjected to a lot of fishing pressure, a lot of commercial interest from some of the countries that have commercial rights in Antarctica, so we are going to try to create the argument for protection.
Wow, and as you're talking about the Arctic, I was just thinking about Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, who is probably about to become Secretary of State because the full Senate is voting on his confirmation today.
Yes, it's terrifying. It's like putting the fox in charge of the hen house.
Mm.
I'm mesmerized by what's happening in the United States, but I think the thing to remember, and where I'm trying to find a little bit of hope and motivation is that the United States is not the only country that has a hand to play in marine conservation or in conservation in general.
Right.
There's another 150 countries that have oceanfront property and that are very interested in achieving 10% of marine protection by 2020. So if the United States is not going to be a player in the next, you know, 2 to 4 years, we have to find other countries that are interested in moving this agenda forward.
Christina Mittermeier is a marine biologist and photographer who specializes in conservation issues surrounding the oceans and indigenous cultures. She's been a writer and photographer for 25 years, and her work centers on the balance between human well-being and healthy ecosystems. And I hope you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, and really just take some time and look at her beautiful photos. There's also a couple of videos where you can see her photos and some of the people that she has photographed. I just think it's so important to take a break from the daily grind of politics right now and look at the beauty of the world. And her photos are just so gorgeous. You can find them at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Christina about the power of photography. And also, if you work for one of these environmental organizations, if you're an environmentalist, a conservationist, what are your thoughts about Christina's opinions about these organizations that aren't doing a good enough job of really showing people the problems of the world? When she worked at Conservation International in the early 90s, she realized that people pay a lot more attention to beautiful photos than they do flipping through a book or reading about science. I mean, that's just the reality. And then maybe then they'll read the book or read about science. So if you'd like to talk about that angle, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a favorite environmental photographer, we'd love to hear from you. If you read National Geographic, what strikes you about those photos? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Christina, you make such a good point about the fact that there are 150 other countries in the world that are currently working on conservation, ocean conservation specifically. Can you talk a little bit about what's inspiring you right now? Because especially in, say, South America, Central America, a lot of conservation groups do a lot with very little funding.
Absolutely. One of the most interesting things about the whole conservation and environmental movement is how it's funded. And when you think about where the money comes from, Americans are just the most generous philanthropic people in the world, and about $270 billion are raised every year for charities in the United States alone. The thing is that most of that money goes to mainly religious charities and then educational charities and the arts, and a very, very small fraction of it, less than 4%, goes to a big category called animals, and that includes dogs and cats and horses and all of life on Earth. So the amount of money going to conservation is really small, and one of the things we need to do is inspire the charitable donations of Americans and people around the world to be more skewed towards the environment that supports us all.
And what really stands out for you on the trips that you have taken in terms of people really taking action and, you know, success stories? What stands out for you?
Just the number of success stories we have out there. One of the things that inspires me, that gives me hope, that keeps me going, is that it doesn't matter where I go in the world. There's so many people doing their share and doing everything they can to call attention, to resolve issues, to promote protection. And there's truly, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people working in their own way to create a better planet. And if that doesn't give us hope, then I don't know what will. So we need to find better ways of supporting all of those efforts because they're all important.
And talk a little bit about the conversations you have with conservation groups to get these messages out. I mean, what are they focusing on right now, given this political climate?
You know, we as a conservation and environmental community, we have a couple of big important mandates that have come from the United Nations in the last couple of years. One of them is the new goals for sustainability. We have a goal to, you know, eradicate poverty, a goal to educate girls in every country in the world. We have a goal to protect our freshwater drinking resources, a goal to, you know, resolve climate change, and then we have a goal to protect the ocean. then we also have the Paris Agreement that most countries in the world signed. And even if President Trump refuses to accept it or even rejects it, the rest of the world is going to continue to work to resolve the issues of climate change. And so I feel like we have a lot of work ahead of us. And my feeling is, Rose, and my hope is that the Trump administration will resolve itself, you know, in the coming months, because it's just it's just almost ridiculous, isn't it?
Mm.
And that we can then go back and focus on these things that really matter.
Right. Well, and what the United States does, unfortunately, affects every country around the globe. What are you hearing from your conservationist friends and other countries that are doing the hard work on the ground?
You know, it's been a really tough couple of weeks, not just for the conservation community, but for everybody. I think it's really demoralizing to get this message from the United States that the environment doesn't matter, that climate change is not real. And a huge part of what we're doing as a community is just trying to motivate each other, trying to lift each other, trying to remind ourselves of the bigger mission. And, you know, conservation and the environment, we work in large geological cycles. So the next few years will be really important and will determine what happens to our planet in the next, you know, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 years. So we want to stay alert, and we don't want to take our finger off the line.
Well, you know, now that we have Myron Ebell, Trump's advisor, saying that the green movement is the greatest threat to freedom, over the next couple of years, and this is what we hear from mostly Republicans and also Democrats, the economy needs to grow at all costs. And what they do is they pit environmental conservation against growth. Right.
Yeah.
And you talk about this a lot. And you've often said that, you know, the highlands of New Guinea, many places in the Amazon where people live in isolation, they sustain the environment. They don't have any other choice, but they take what they need and they use everything they take, which is such a foreign concept to most politicians. So can you talk about how people who care about the planet push back against this notion that the economy needs to grow at all costs?
Yeah, this is a concept that we've been sold on, you know, this imperative of growing the economy at the expense of everything else. And, you know, I had hoped under President Obama that that was going to change, but it hasn't. So I think it falls back on the individual. And I've adopted this idea of enoughness, and this is something that I've learned from indigenous communities around the world. Being happy with just enough. We're driven by this marketing greed to consume, and that is a huge driver of the problems around the world. And so having an internal metric, an internal sense of, you know, rejecting consumerism is really, really important, and that comes from enoughness, just looking around and saying, I have enough to be happy, I have enough to be healthy, and I don't need to be part of this machine that's destroying the planet with this idea.
What does this look like on the ground? Why don't we start with the positive? Talk about a few places where you have been, the highlands of New Guinea, for example, or many places in the Amazon where people believe in sustaining the environment and really taking only what they need.
You know, it really is in most places around the world, and everywhere you go, because we define poverty as the lack of material wealth and the lack of access to material resources, but for most people, especially the people that live closest to nature, healthy nature provides most of the things they need and has been doing so for hundreds of thousands of years. So this new, you know, this middle class phenomenon that we've been experiencing for the last 30, 40, 50 years is new.
Mm.
And of course, we all need to aspire for people to have access to health services and to the basic necessities that a human needs. But when you go to places like the Amazon, people do so well with so little, and the thing that you come to realize is that their happiness and their well-being is coming from other things. And those things are so ephemeral, you know, you cannot really touch them. There are things like the opportunity to speak your own language, the opportunity to participate in your cultural traditions, being surrounded by your family and friends, being in touch with nature. All of those things, you know, really fill people with a sense of well-being. And if we could go back a little bit to rejoicing in just the good things that mean to be a human on this planet, I think, you know, we all can make a difference.
And talk about your experience in actually meeting people who live in the highlands of New Guinea or many of these places that you have photographed in the Amazon.
You know, I grew up in Mexico, and Mexico is a really wonderful country where we still have an enormous tradition of indigenous knowledge. So growing surrounded by indigenous people is not a new thing for me. I grew up that way. So when I visit places like the highlands of New Guinea or the central Amazon, visiting with indigenous people, for me it's not that foreign. And unlike many other photographers who have focused on portraying people as museum specimens because they're so rare and they dress so differently, I have focused my photography on trying to find the commonalities, the things that make us, you know, similar in the human experience. So I focus on, you know, what's family life. You know, I'm not a rabid feminist, but I really do gravitate toward, you know, female photography, women's issues. I love spending time with mothers and sisters and people that remind me of my own human experience. And I think if we focus on the things that make us similar as opposed to on the things that divide us and make us different, like this administration is doing, we have a better chance of peace on Earth.
And on your website, you have photos of the Kayapo people in Brazil's Amazon, and their way of life is threatened by the, is it the Belo Monte Dam?
Yeah, that's another one of those of those development projects that make no sense. The Kayapo people in the central Suriname, they're actually on the southern part of the Amazon. They've been there for thousands of years, and they've been surviving in the forest, you know, living a very sustainable life where they grow some of the food that they need, but they survive from hunting. And, you know, the key to being able to survive that way is to not overexploit, to only take what you need and to use everything you take. And that is true of indigenous communities around the world. Until recently, the Kayapo were facing threats that had to do more with the invasion of their lands from gold miners and from cattle ranchers. But, you know, just in the last 5-10 years, the government of Brazil approved not just the Belo Monte Dam, they approved a series of enormous mega dams in the Amazon to try to harness the power of hydroelectric power for electricity. Mm-hmm. And it's turned out to be catastrophic. So the Belo Monte Dam has impacted about 40,000 people. It went into operation last year, and it really will change the lives of a lot of indigenous people that until now led a very self-sustaining life. The good news is that the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, was recently overthrown in Brazil, and the 60 dams that were planned for the Amazon have now been put on hold. So that's the good news. And I think it has a lot to do with all the protests around the Belo Monte Dam and all the international attention that we've been trying to drive through projects like mine and many others who have spoken out against these types of development projects.
How do you find the balance between showing the beauty and just the everyday way of life and then also showing the ugly side? I mean, I was trying to talk to you positively for just a few minutes, and then, of course, we had to talk about this dam. But, I mean, this is the reality that we're facing. You know, and in the last 40 years, according to Greenpeace, the Brazilian Amazon lost 18% of its rainforest, illegal logging, soy plantations, lots and lots of cattle ranching. I mean, this is an area about the size of California. This is massive.
It is massive. It's very large. Absolutely. So, I mean, for me, where I find a sliver of hope is in the things that I can do as a person to help. And cattle ranching, the beef industry, is one of the enormous drivers of deforestation in the Amazon, of climate change. And so for me to avoid eating meat or to shift my diet to a more plant-based diet is something I can do every day. And I can feel really good to be doing, you know, a huge thing for the environment just by doing that one thing.
Can I ask you, I'm hearing this more from environmentalists. I've been a vegan for 20 years, so I'm a little biased on this issue. But more and more environmentalists who are coming on our shows, scientists, say that they have stopped eating meat. How did you come to this decision?
You know, you start seeing the impact of the beef industry on our environment all around. It's not just that massive tracts of rainforest are just cut down to put cows in them. It's also that the beef industry produces such an enormous amount of emissions, methane, carbon dioxide, so it's a huge driver of climate change on our planet, and it's a personal choice. You know, I don't fully stop eating meat because I travel a lot, and sometimes in places where I go to, there's no other choice. That's what's on the table. But if it's my choice and in my home, I never buy meat anymore, and I really try very hard not to eat it.
Christina Mittermeier is a Mexican-born marine biologist and photographer who specializes in conservation issues surrounding the ocean and indigenous cultures. She's been a writer and a photographer for the past 25 years. She co-founded Sea Legacy. This is a nonprofit that creates powerful images to change the narrative around the world's oceans. We'd love to hear from you if you have any questions or comments for Christina. If you'd like to talk about the power of photographs, especially as we have climate deniers running the U.S. government. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about California Governor Jerry Brown's $179 billion state budget. When he unveiled it, he said the trajectory of revenue growth is declining. He said he's going to address deficits by slowing growth in spending on public schools and other social services. He also said the state will not spend any more money on low-income housing because he says it's just too expensive. So who will be impacted most by this budget? That's tomorrow at 10. We hope you can join us. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And every Friday, there's going to be so much to talk about. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Christina Mittermeier. She's a marine biologist and a photographer who specializes in conservation issues surrounding the ocean and indigenous cultures. And when she worked as a communications director at Conservation International in the early 90s, she realized that people pay more attention to beautiful photos than they do to science. So she went to school to study photography, and here she is later, a couple decades later. She's published and edited 24 coffee table books, and she was recently recognized as one of the world's top 40 most influential outdoor photographers by Outdoor Magazine. If you have any questions or comments for Christina, we'd love to hear from you. And if you work for an environmental or conservation organization, what are you thinking right now? I mean, let's be honest about what we're facing. Climate deniers are running the U.S. government. Donald Trump is filling his cabinet with them. And so what role do you think conservation groups, photographers, what role do they need to play at this time? And if you have a favorite photographer you'd like to talk about or how a photo has struck you recently, we'd also love to talk about that. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Christina has traveled all around the globe. She has seen more than most of us. She has seen the direct effects of climate change. So if you have any questions for her about the changes she's seen, we'd also love to hear from you. Let's go to Jeff in San Francisco. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a quick question for the guest about choosing a non-fish-based diet based upon the overfishing of our oceans and the other issues related to ocean ecosystems.
Well, thank you. Christina, in some of the videos I watched about you, I also learned that back in the 80s, when you chose to study biochemical engineering, you learned a lot about our relationship with fish and the drastic decline in fish.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to university in the 1980s in Mexico to study how the ocean back then, we believed, was going to feed the planet. And I think by now we all have realized that it's not an infinite resource as we thought it was, and that we have depleted 80% of the fish stocks on the planet already. That said, there's a lot of good efforts to promote the aquaculture the right way. There's a lot of bad aquaculture projects as well, but there's a lot of good fish that we can eat. And I think especially in poor countries, people still depend on, you know, coastal resources for their everyday survival. So what we're learning is that if you protect ecosystems and if you create marine protected areas, those areas really act as sanctuaries and nurseries for fish to thrive, and the fish that spill out of a marine protected area can feed a lot of people. So for me, the real problem is in this massive industrial fishing that happens out of sight where it's very difficult to regulate, and you know, it's just this expectation that the ocean is infinite, and it really isn't. So for myself, I eat fish whenever I have caught it myself with a line and where I know where it's coming from, and I encourage everybody to ask in a restaurant and ask in your fish market where your fish comes from.
Yeah.
A lot of locally sourced fish provides a lot of good jobs, and you know, especially in places like British Columbia where I live, wild fisheries of salmon sustain an enormous number of people, and it's a resource that if we maintain, you know, healthy ecosystems, can sustain a lot of people and a lot of jobs.
Right. And Jeff, I hope you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, because we've done a number of shows about this. If you just search for fish, you'll find those shows. Christina, can you talk about some of the people you've met in areas where their livelihood really depends on a healthy fishery? And sadly, because of increased demand from the West, those fisheries are being depleted. Because you also, through your work, you're taking photographs, but you're also giving a voice to a lot of the people who are affected by the depletion of fisheries, for example.
Yeah, you know, I've seen both. I've seen areas where conservation and marine protected areas have benefited coastal communities, not just because they provide an incredible source of food and tourism. You know, diving and snorkeling are huge sources of revenue for some of these small communities, but also because when you protect the ocean, you are creating resilience for climate change. When you have healthy coral reefs, healthy mangroves, those really act as barriers for storm surges and hurricanes, and it's really important for coastal communities, especially where poor people live.
Mm-hmm.
I've also seen the opposite. I just spent 3 weeks in southern India, where there's been just an enormous increase in fishing activity. So the government providing subsidies for fishing boats for a large number of people, and the result is not surprising. All the big fish are gone, and what they're catching is just tiny little fish that are just not enough to feed people. So they're using them to feed chicken, the chicken industry. And you can just see how that's not going to have a happy ending.
Hmm. Wow. Well, thank you for calling in, Jeff. Let's go next to Steve in Berkeley. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I haven't heard too much of the program, but I heard that Christine is interested in not only in the oceans, but in their impact on indigenous people. And I've been in touch with a group in Colombia on the Caribbean coast called the Kogi, who were one of the first groups to identify that climate change was affecting them. And they've also been involved in protecting some mangroves on the coast, and I'm just wondering if she knows about them, and if she's maybe even been there taking pictures.
Thank you.
That's a lovely question. I actually have been to the Kogi place where they live in the Santa Marta Massif on the coast of Colombia. I was there, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, and the biggest problem they had back then was that they were right smack in the middle of where the drug trafficking was happening. Today, their biggest problem is climate change, and it's not just the Kogi Indians. The Kuna Indians that live in the coast of Colombia and Panama are already having to relocate because they live on small islands that are already, you know, suffering from the effects of sea level rise. And this is a problem that's happening for indigenous people all over the world. I just came back from Greenland, where Inuit hunters are seeing the ice that they use as highways for, you know, where they go hunting and fishing. The ice is literally melting underneath their boots, and
wow,
pretty soon they're not going to have access to their traditional fishing and hunting grounds.
Christina, do people ever ask you to bring messages to the West. I mean, the United States, we use more than we need. We're contributing so, you know, many more greenhouse gases to the planet. Does anyone ever say, you know, these larger countries that are ruining our way of life really need to step up?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, most indigenous people that I spend time with are not completely isolated. They get news from the West. They know a lot of what's happening out there, and there's a sense of resentment and sadness that people are so blind to the effects that we have on our own habits in the West. And so a huge part of my photography is to make sure that the effects of our own actions are not invisible, and that the people that are being impacted are, you know, are at least not being ignored.
How do you go about doing that?
You know, I do it through storytelling. I find that as humans, we are hardwired to listen to stories, and it is so much more fun to listen to a personal narrative of, you know, whatever it is, a journey or somebody you meet, and you can connect so much more at an emotional level when you learn from a story about these types of things. So I like writing. I spend a lot of time, you know, trying to put my images to words and trying to share those. We're so lucky to have the internet these days, because it's like a virtual campfire where we all can sit around and listen to stories every day. And so I try to use that, and I'm very lucky that I have a very engaged and loyal following on social media. And every time I put a picture up, I try to share a little story of something I learned or how I felt, and try to get other people to see the world the way I've seen it.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Steve. You can find Christina's website at yourcallradio.org. We also have some other environmental photographers listed there. Let's go next to Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for your show. I just wanted to back Christina up on the fact that most environmental organizations are really unwilling to allocate the kind of money it takes to do good communications, photography, all of that. I've worked in the environmental field for 30 years. And often as the communications person, and we just got almost nothing. So we had to figure out how to do stuff. But luckily now with the internet, you know, and using cell phones and whatnot, you know, you can produce a lot of social media and stuff, but I think that's still a problem. Also, I just wanted to make a comment on, you know, what are all the environmental groups doing right now? Good question. Well, a lot of the big greens are totally reassessing. You know, I mean, they put how much money and time was put into stopping the KXL pipeline, quote unquote stopping.
Right.
And there wasn't a long vision that, you know, what if, you know, I don't think it was ever discussed. I never heard it discussed. You know, what if Trump gets in? What if it totally goes the other direction? So I think there's a lot of backpedaling going on, but I think the strong work of people like Christina and the community and indigenous groups and groups doing grassroots environmental justice work, which didn't switch, you know, it stayed true to what it's doing. That's going to be, you know, well, hopefully we'll get some more support and we'll get and build a bigger movement.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for calling, Denny. These are such important questions. Christina, can you talk about, you don't have to name names, but talk about the interactions you've had with some of these big environmental groups that you feel are not doing a good enough job of communicating well with the public and then really showing people the changes that the world is going through right now.
Well, you want to hear the good news?
Yes, let's start with the good news first.
I think most of the large environmental and conservation groups really want to do a better job at communications. And you see it with groups like Conservation International, who has invested a lot more in, you know, getting Conservation International, for example, has a beautiful series called Nature is Speaking. And I know that it was funded by the generosity of a philanthropist. And it's, again, storytelling using celebrities like Julia Roberts or Harrison Ford. And it's had a huge impact because it's very approachable and people can really understand, feel an emotional connection and feel invested in the problems and in the solutions. And I think that is true of a lot of the other major nonprofit organizations. I think a huge part of the problem is that the foundations that have been created over the last 30 years to support the environmental community have a very narrow mandate to support science. And so a huge part of the work is to educate the foundations, and these are family foundations, corporate foundations, to expand the allocation of their resources to include communications. because communications has changed a lot. You know, for many, many years, we didn't really know that communications is a science and that metrics and psychology, for example, are really important in terms of getting people not just to understand messages, but to actually take actions and change behaviors. We know a lot more now. And so I think the time to invest in communications, and especially on visual communications, is now.
And we had a scientist on the show recently who said that even the messaging is off. For example, she feels like everyone needs to be on the same page when you're talking about, for example, Christina, I'll ask you this question. If there were two major changes you would like to see, say, for example, in the U.S. government, you know, you were president of the United States, what changes or new laws would you like to implement?
That's a great question, one that I haven't thought very much about, but I really feel that we need to have some accountability for the people that create problems like pollution in any sense, mm-hmm. you know. CO2 pollution, when we talk about a carbon tax, people often reject it because they feel that they're going to be personally taxed. But I think we need to tax corporations and polluters for the damage they're doing. And I think they need to be held accountable to restore the ecosystems they're damaging. And I don't feel that that's been done yet. You know, people are trying to be politically correct, and I feel like we need to take like an approach like Trump, but on, you know, for the good of the world.
Well, and I started asking you a pretty serious question just about soul searching and your role as a photographer. Tell us a little more about how you got into photography and conservation.
I wanted to be a scientist, and I really wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be out there in the ocean with dolphins. That was the driver when I first went to school. When I first realized how big the problems of our ocean that's when I became a conservationist, and I was really, really lucky to find my first job out of university almost 30 years ago with Conservation International, because I learned a lot about the really important role that science plays. I became a photographer by accident. I was carrying somebody else's camera and snapped a few pictures, and those pictures ended up being published for a huge museum exhibition, and they were credited to somebody else, to the owner of the camera. And, you know, I realized that maybe I had a skill that needed to be developed, so I went back to school, and I started taking photography more seriously. The interesting thing, Rose, is that for me, photography has no meaning outside of the purpose of using it to advance conservation and the environment. Mm. If tomorrow we were to resolve the issues surrounding extinction, biodiversity loss, pollution, I would put my camera down. You know, I don't do it for the joy or the pleasure of photography, even though I find it a beautiful craft. I do it because it's a very, very useful tool for communicating. And it's not just communicating with the people that are looking at my photographs. I feel that it's a conversation that goes three ways. It goes back to the people that I'm photographing. It's a dialogue with them. And then it's a dialogue with the people that are looking at my pictures. And I'm just the bridge.
So we have the dolphins to thank for your work. Talk a little bit about your experiences in taking photos of underwater life. You have some incredible orcas, and then I hope everyone can go look at your work. Just really amazing photos of underwater life.
Well, thank you very much, Rose. I am very lucky that I live with one of the best photographers of our generation, Paul Nicklin. My partner has made a career taking photographs in the Arctic, where he grew up in an Inuit community. And he has become the best underwater photographer of our generation. So he has been really kind in mentoring me and teaching me the secrets of underwater photography. And I've taken this on not with the pursuit of trying to photograph wildlife, because even though I love doing it, for me the mission is really to be able to turn my camera from the ocean onto the coast, mm-hmm. where 1 billion people live on the edge of the ocean, and try to tell the story of coastal communities from the perspective of the water. And so I feel like my skill set is improving, and that's where I want to spend the next 10 years of my life, documenting what's happening with sea level rise, with the loss of fisheries, and also some, you know, good news stories, the benefits of marine protected areas,
yeah.
and how coastal communities really thrive when the ocean is protected.
I love the section of your website. Well, they're all amazing, but Girl Power is just fantastic. The collection is inspired by women and young girls who make their lives on the edge of the ocean, care for their communities, and continue the tradition of their ancestors.
You know, I think it's no secret that women around the world, and men, but women work really hard, and they are the soul and the spirit of every community. And when you empower women, when you empower young girls, you really bring the entire community up. Women, I think we have a way of nurturing and caring for those around us and looking at the interest of future generations with a different perspective than men do. And I've always felt really welcome and very much at ease spending time with women around the world. And wherever I've been, and you ask women what they want, the thing that most women want around the world is control over their own reproductive future.
Mm.
And I know, and access to health for their children and education. I mean, these are not unreasonable requests.
Mm.
And because I'm a mother and I have children of my own, I really sympathize with that, and I try to, you know, bring an empathy to the struggles and the triumphs and just the beautiful work that women do around the world.
Mm. It's so important. You have written that it's difficult for women to make progress in the world of photography. It's still a man's world. But being a woman has so many benefits, especially when you're talking about taking pictures of girls and, you know, they introduce you into their lives.
Yeah, you know, if you focus on the challenges of being a woman, especially in a field like wildlife and nature photography that is very physical and can be a little dangerous, you know, you're not going to get very far. I chose to look at the advantages I had by being a woman, and one of them is that women are much more easily digested into a community. So for me, it's wonderful to arrive in a place where I've never been before, and in a matter of days to become part of the fabric and everyday life of a community. And, you know, when I was younger and I had to travel with my children, they were the passport into the intimate lives of people that otherwise would have been very difficult to photograph. Because, you know, there's this empathy and there's this generosity. I've always felt so welcome in people's homes everywhere around the world.
Christina Mittermeier is a marine biologist and photographer who specializes in conservation issues surrounding the ocean and indigenous cultures. And we have time for a few more questions. Let's hear from Sean in San Francisco. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I want to first thank you for your show so much. It's been inspiring at a time when I feel very uninspired.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate the intersection that you've discussed between politics and environmentalism and women's issues and psychology and everything else. So just thank you very much. And I wanted to ask if there was a photograph that either from early on in your career, not one that you took or maybe one you took, that stands out for you among all the, I'm sure, thousands of photographs you've seen, tens of thousands.
That's a lovely question. You know, the first time that I ever actually made a photo, you know, I think to become a good photographer, those of us who work in this profession probably had to make 50,000 really bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes a moment when you look in, back then it was not digital, it was film. When I look at this photograph I made of a woman carrying a goose on her head in a very remote corner of Yunnan in China, and it turned out beautiful. And I felt, okay, finally this steep learning curve of understanding how a camera works, how exposure and depth of field determine the way that a photograph looks, and all these other things that you need to keep in the back of your mind when you're creating images, at some point they become like just these blurry, you know, thing that feeds and informs a photograph, but it's your creative mind that eventually creates an image. And the first time that happened to me was with this image, and I was blown away.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, yeah, I'm going to be a photographer.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for that question. We have one more question from Tally. She says, I'm wondering, aside from non-meat-based diets and redirecting our donations toward conservation efforts and supporting better environmental communication, are there other high-impact, small-scale changes the general public can make at home to address the most important conservation issues? And also, how can we support Sea Legacy to continue the work that you do?
That's another lovely question. So, This is a question that I get asked so often, and the one big thing I can tell you is that you have to care enough to stay informed, to read about the things that we eat, the things that we buy, the impact that we have on our own footprint. So I put together a list of 10 things that we all can do today to support, you know, a healthier ocean and a healthier environment. So if you go to sealegacy.org, you'll find that list of 10 things there, and you will find a button to donate. And we have a 501c3 in the United States, so donations in the U.S. are tax-deductible, and we very much appreciate it. They keep us out there in the water photographing these things every day of the year.
Well, Christina, it has been a pleasure chatting with you. I just wonder, as you're about to take your trip, you're leaving tomorrow for the Antarctic Peninsula. You know, so many people are really struggling with what's happening in this country right now. Can you just leave us with some final thoughts? I mean, you know, they always say that travel changes your perspective on life. And so many of us can think of those amazing travel experiences that have changed the way we view the world. But, I mean, you do it on such a regular basis. And so I just wonder, I'm sure it's just changed the way that you live your life.
You know, when I travel like this, the thing that I look forward most, I mean, I really love not being online. I love losing myself in nature, forgetting that the world is out there, and just being present in what I'm doing, because I find that that's when you create your best work. I have to be honest, I'm terrified of leaving this time, because in a month's time when I come back, I don't know what kind of world I'm going to find.
Wow.
So I'm going to leave you all with the homework of please resist. Please stand up for this. Please don't give up. Please be hopeful. And hopefully when I come back in a month, we have a brighter future to look up to.
Well, resist. That's right. And we would love to have you back when you're back from your trip. We'd love to hear about how it went. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for all the beauty that you bring to the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose. It's been a pleasure.
Christina Mittermeier is a Mexican-born marine biologist and photographer who specializes in conservation issues surrounding the ocean and indigenous cultures. And I hope you can take a look at her work. It's just beautiful. You can find it at yourcallradio.org, and also check out more about Sea Legacy, the nonprofit she created to create images to change the narrative around the world's oceans. And coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about California Governor Jerry Brown's $179 billion state budget. When he announced the budget recently, he said the trajectory of revenue growth is declining. And he said he's going to address the expected deficit by slowing growth in spending on public schools and social services. He also said the state will not spend more on low-income housing because it's just too expensive. So who will be most impacted by this budget? That is tomorrow at 10 a.m. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Helena Murphy and Stephanie Purcell are our volunteers. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. And you can email us feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.